The Guardian.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
Hello, this is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratowski. On this week's programme, Google is facing legal action from the EU and from the US over what's being described as a perfect storm of litigation. The BBC Trust is being petitioned to open up the Director General selection process. RIM, the flailing BlackBerry maker, may have a second wind from Africa. Movie maker Alan Sorkin tries his hand at bringing a tech story to the silver screen with his Steve Jobs biopic. And we hear from Nook, the e-reader platform, about their next product and how it will take on the Amazon Kindle Fire and the iPad market. Keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm joined in the studio today to discuss all of these things and quite probably more by Charles Arthur, The Guardian's technology editor, and Jemima Kish, The Guardian's digital media correspondent. Welcome both to the pod.
Hi.
Hello.
First up in the news this week, Google's legal woes continue as both the European Commission and the US Federal Trade Commission train their eyeballs on a whole host of potential regulatory infringements. Charles, first, what can you tell me about predatory pricing?
This is an accusation that's being levelled at Google by ICOMP, which is a Microsoft-funded lobbying group, which basically doesn't like anything that Google does, pretty much. And one of the arguments they're putting forward is that the way that Android is priced, i.e. free, constitutes predatory pricing because Google is looking to make the money back that it spends on it in the future through things like advertising. And their argument is that constitutes predatory pricing. They're saying if they were just giving it away and weren't trying to get the money back, that'd be fine. That'd just be a gift. But when you price something under competitors' prices in order to gain market share and then to drive them out, that constitutes predatory pricing. I don't know whether this has yet been taken up by the European Commission, the Antitrust Commission, but they are already looking at Google on two counts. First of all, they're looking at Google's search share and whether the way that it organizes search results, advertising, and a couple of other elements, including sort of the way they pull data from information sites such as Yelp, whether that constitutes an abuse of monopoly. And in Europe, if you're just a monopoly and you exert a large influence on the market, then that can bring you to the attention of the European Commission. And Joachim Almunia has been negotiating with Google since the summer over this. The progress seems to have been slow, and the feeling is that he will either reach a settlement soon with Google or else issue a statement of objections.
But this particular issue is something that the FTC has been watching Google for quite carefully. I know that in Europe, certainly they were called up for this and had to stop putting their own products at the top of search results.
They haven't stopped doing it. No, the point entirely is that they're continuing to do it. And that by doing that, the argument goes from a number of companies, which actually it's worth mentioning, are also members of ICOMP. The argument, though, is that Google pushes them down, pushes its own products, such as shopping, such as YouTube, such as Maps and so on, up to the top, and therefore disadvantages them. And the argument that the EC is trying to tease out is this an abuse of the search monopoly to create a monopoly elsewhere? And if so, is it to the detriment of consumers? And the FTC is looking at exactly the same argument. What I understand is that the FTC has, the FTC staff have passed a recommendation to the FTC commissioners, there are five of them, saying that yes, Google is doing this and that it is to the detriment and therefore some action should be taken. And rather as in Europe, there'll be negotiations, there might be a settlement. In the US, there'll be discussions between the FTC and Google, and there'll either be what's called a consent decree, which is the same sort of thing that Microsoft signed with the Department of Justice, in which case they say, okay, we'll behave, or else there'll be a whacking great legal fight.
Conceptually, I find it fascinating because it is a private company, and so therefore it's unsurprising that it's trying to pimp its own products. It's not as if Google has signed a decree with the universe saying, and we will be a completely neutral technology and deliver unto you, you know, totally neutral search results.
Yeah, but
it is Google Corp.
But it's designed as a check and a balance against the company itself. I mean, it's sort of its own worst enemy, isn't it? Because obviously it's in their interest to get as much business as possible, and you can't solely rely on their own responsibility or sense of responsibility to measure themselves.
The point being, Microsoft is a private company as well, and when they used their Windows influence to push Internet Explorer, they got dinged for that as well in the States and in Europe. The point being, if Google is in effect driving out smaller competitors or, you know, rising competitors, so, you know, Foundem, which is a British company, British sort of vertical search company, say, well, you know, we're not really given a fair shake because we get pushed down. Google artificially pushes us down, is their argument. And they've done a lot of analysis which really does seem to correlate with this. So, you know, if that's to the detriment of consumers, then you would expect the EC and the FTC to act.
Jemima.
In terms of fines, can we look at the precedent of the fines that the European Commission imposed on Microsoft?
It can levy 10% of world revenues against the company. So,
fifth biggest company in the world, then Google. So,
dang, that's a few pennies, isn't it?
It's quite a bit. It's rather more than, for example, the FTC fined it. The FTC fined it sort of $20 million or $22.5 million for what it did with circumnavigating cookies on Safari. The U.S. Department of Justice fined it $500 million for running adverts for illegal Canadian pharmaceutical companies between 2004 and 2010.
Sergey might have to sell his rocket ship, I think.
Possibly. He'll be thrown.
He'll make up for it with his glasses.
He'll only have two.
Incredible. So practically, what would this mean for the search and global online services landscape?
It would be quite a dramatic change for Google because it would mean that other people, in effect, were deciding what it could put where in its search. And that's something that it's resisted very, very strongly. Worth mentioning also is that the EC is looking at Android, and not in the sense of the predatory pricing thing, but just whether it should have, if it does reach in a negotiated settlement with Google, whether that should extend to Android as well. And then separately of all this, in both the US and Europe, the Motorola subsidiary, which Google bought and completed the acquisition of in August, is being investigated over whether the way that it wields its standards essential patents, that is, patents that have to be used if you're going to conform to various mobile and Wi-Fi standards and H.264 decoding, whether the way that it's used those, seeking injunctions against Apple and Microsoft, whether that's actually an abuse of monopoly. And again, the case seems pretty strong. It's unusual for a company to be investigated in this way without some sort of quite strong prima facie cause.
And what is the timeline, do you think, for this, for all of these things? Can we see something happening in the next 6 months, next year?
We should expect something on the whole search question really by the end of the year, I would think. And for the Motorola investigation, that's been going on for a while, but I suspect that it could be another 6 months or so before there's a real clear move there.
Read up on all of this at guardian.co.uk/technology. Now, there's a petition on change.org that's demanding that the BBC Trust opens up the appointment process for the new BBC Director General by requiring candidates to release their public statement about their vision for the BBC. So, Jemima, tell me a little bit about this story.
Well, there's two things going on here. One is the petition, which has been powered by Open Democracy, which has been looking at various institutional issues and problems in the BBC for quite a while, even before the whole Jimmy Savile thing happened. They have concluded that this open process of recruitment rather than kind of old boys club behind the doors thing, which does seem very outdated, would really increase public trust and public involvement in the decision of an appointment to head up, you know, extremely important public institution. The second thing is a kind of, I suppose it's a seizing of the moment among BBC technology staff who are organising themselves quite efficiently behind the scenes and talking about an opportunity to have somebody take over who's much more digitally savvy
Is this though not a fantasy idea? Because certainly the BBC technology staff have historically, especially those who have left, have historically looked at the BBC and done a bit of crying about its digital.
Well, exactly
how it is that they allow people to express themselves digitally,
which is why there's a very big mountain to climb. But they have to do it. The BBC absolutely has to adapt for the internet age. It doesn't have a choice. I spoke to Anthony Barnett, who founded Open Democracy, and he described it very eloquently that programmes have to come first, but that the BBC invented radio, then television and colour television, and now is faced with a whole new platform again. And it's part of their remit to innovate and to provide people with amazing programmes on that new platform. So they need somebody at the helm that is going to enable them to do that. Now, there have been some crazy names thrown out here.
And by the helm, you're talking Director General.
I'm talking Director General. Now, I think it's worth saying that when these names were suggested to me, it was very much in the context of people like. So perhaps not these people, but you know, that this might be quite crazy, but
I know this fantasy list of technologically minded.
It's a sort of fantasy DG.
Yes. It is. Okay. Right.
Okay.
Go
so,
for it. And by the way, if you've got suggestions for your fantasy director general, preferably technologically minded, then send them in.
Oh, we'd love to hear those.
At Guardian TW. Fantastic opportunity to send in your thoughts about how the BBC should be run.
So we've got Ian Hargreaves, who is a former director of BBC News, but he also led the Hargreaves Review into copyright reform. So would definitely be more open to the internet, arguably, than other candidates.
And also certainly has a background as somebody in the regulation sphere.
Yes.
As well as somebody in the commercial sphere, dealing perhaps not with content, but with, you know, how content could be formulated in the future.
I did work under him when he was the editor of The Independent. So, yeah, he's pretty effective, actually,
yeah.
I would say.
Okay, so he's looking pretty good. Formerly of this parish, Emily Bell, who used to be Guardian Unlimited's editor-in-chief, obviously extremely talented journalist and a very effective manager, but she's extremely savvy with digital strategy. She, I think, loves her new job at Columbia University.
Yeah. But where she heads up the Tau Center for Digital Journalism, where she has flocks of young people with bright eyes and excitability looking at how they can transform digital journalism in
well,
the future.
Well, she could possibly be the first female director general of the BBC, which might also be something that the Trust is looking to do.
Now, actually, can I just throw this in? But both of these people that have been suggested have come from print, not from television. Is this a detriment or is this an asset?
Well, I don't know. Could you really argue that Emily was mostly print? I mean, she was key in driving the Guardian's digital strategy.
It's pretty hard. If you're going to be old enough to have the knowledge to run the BBC, then you're probably going to have started in print.
Yeah.
And it does need someone who's been a journalist. I mean, that's really what the whole George Entwistle saga showed us, was that you needed someone who has that natural curiosity that journalists
exactly. bring to what they do. It's about aptitude, I think. Certainly experience, but proven aptitude in just being open and exploratory. I think that's really important. Okay, so further down the list, we have Tony Aggie. Now, he's quite interesting because he's been at the BBC forever. Currently heading up the BBC archive and has done some fantastic work, but he's quite low profile, extremely well connected, extremely committed. One of those, you know, cutting down the middle, it will say the BBC inside. So he's definitely very interesting to watch. There are a couple of elements to this, though. One is obviously there's an interest among technology staff in bringing in a director general who understands how to do the internet. The other is in someone who understands how to think like the internet. The Newsnight report that kind of framed Lord McAlpine incorrectly related to the paedophile charges forgot or just had no understanding of that Twitter would go out and identify him. And that is being mooted as something that is indicative of the lack of understanding and management about how influential the internet is.
I'm wondering, though, that the suggestions that are being made and the demand that the BBC Trust opens up the appointment process doesn't actually consider the job description of somebody who's running something that is as multi-headed, as multifaceted as the BBC. So somebody who emphasizes digital could conceivably have as much of a backlash as somebody who has no interest in digital whatsoever, because they'll be accused of being completely focused on one element.
I'd really love to know what Mark Thompson thinks, actually. He's the absolute obvious person to go and ask what the next BBC Director General should be like, because you know he's seen it inside, he's seen it outside.
We've got a few more names. We've got Mike Bracken and Tom Loosemore, both formerly of this parish, both now working on the Government Digital Service, and also Bill Thompson, again, actually formerly of The Guardian. I'm not just suggesting Guardian names, honestly.
Jemima Kish for DG, I think. That's what we're at. Well, fantastic. Yes, and as we said at the top, please do send in your suggestions for DG. And if we do get enough petitions for Jemima, we will put her forward onto
the change.org. I don't own enough suits.
Too bad. I think possibly.
Don't own any suits.
We will knit you some suits out of some mung beans as you are of this parish. Yes. But do tweet those to @GuardianTW, and we shall consider them in the most appropriate way. Now, Charles, we've spent a lot of time talking about the inexorable decline of the company behind the BlackBerry, RIM. But it seems that there's a possibility that it might be saved from devastation from an unexpected corner, from Nigeria. What's the story here?
Turns out that Nigeria is one of the growth markets for RIM, because having a BlackBerry there indicates that you're wealthy. And there's a rather interesting article in The Guardian which points out that one of the first things people do when they get promoted to a suitable salary is to go and buy a BlackBerry. And that means that they make up a very significant proportion of the smartphones that are sold there. And it's generally true that RIM's best markets are emerging markets, comparatively fast growth economies where people are moving from having very small amounts of money per day to suddenly getting a burgeoning middle class, and young people who suddenly got money who want to stay in touch. Things like BlackBerry Messenger for them are absolutely perfect.
Where are these other growth markets?
Malaysia, Indonesia is a sort of particular areas, and the Middle East is another key one, because there's lots of teenagers there.
There were the issues with the Middle East and governments trying to shut down BlackBerry.
Certainly they were threatening to do unless they got some more access to content. But certainly, you know, just generally in Middle Eastern countries, kids who are, you know, of the opposite sex, who are banned from meeting in person, love to use BBM to communicate, because it's quiet, it's private, and it's secure. And generally, you know, in the US, their market share is plummeting, to the extent that the New York Times recently ran a piece suggesting that it's embarrassing to be seen with a BlackBerry, which I thought felt a little bit overblown. But the reality is that the install base and the ComScore numbers that come out every month show it, that the install base is just plummeting for RIM, and so they've got a big problem there. But in these emerging markets where they can sell the phones comparatively cheaply, and yet it's still a status symbol, they're doing well.
Maybe they need to organise a few riots somewhere.
Other riots are available. Yeah. Is it possible to maintain afloat, maintain being alive, maintain, you know, any kind of bottom line by focusing on these markets, or is this a passing phenomenon?
The problem is that as those markets grow bigger, as the smartphone potential market grows bigger, then you get sort of striation. So top-end people tend to go for an iPhone or for a Samsung Galaxy S model. In the mid-range, you then get people who either go for a BlackBerry or they start seeing lots of Android phones being offered. And at the bottom end, the BlackBerry is trying to compete with the really, really cheap Android smartphones. So that market sort of falls away and just gets stretched like a rubber band. They're the stretched middle, in effect.
Well, we'll keep an eye on this over the next few months. The tablet and e-book reader market is heating up in advance of the 2012 holiday season, and it's more than just the Kindle Fire that's causing the conflagration. Did you like that? I like that. The Nook, the Barnes & Noble-owned e-book reader, is launching a new product line too, and Charles spoke with Jim Hilt, the VP of Nook, to find out how the company plans to compete head-on with Amazon and the rest of the market.
Jim, Nook is, or rather Barnes & Noble, is the largest bookseller in the US, which I think might surprise some people.
We have a long heritage of bookselling in the US. We've been at it for decades. We've been an innovator in getting great content to people for a long time. Whether it was the introduction of discounting on books or the introduction of the large format bookstore that would really expand the selection of books across the U.S. and then all the way to the innovation that we're delivering with Nook. We have, you know, been at it for a long time and have been successful at it.
So you've got 700 retail stores, 600 college stores, but of course the store that most people tend to think about is an online store. And you're now introducing the Nook tablets. You've got two tablets going here, which are coming out this Christmas in the UK. You've got a 7-inch priced at $159, and you've got a 9-inch priced at $229. Just talk us through what it is that you're aiming to do with these devices, because obviously other people will have heard of 7-inch tablets, which are priced the same from other book retailers, let's say.
We think that there is a tremendous opportunity for the UK reader to have a color tablet that is tuned specifically for the content experience, whether it's books, it's, you know, beautiful magazine experiences, it's, you know, great, rich movie content. And when we looked at the market, we felt that there was room for the innovation that we're putting into Nook HD and Nook HD Plus. The UK is, you know, one of the preeminent book markets in the world, so it made sense that one of the largest booksellers in the world would, you know, come in and offer the Nook ecosystem to UK customers.
So looking at the, just taking the 7-inch tablet, it's very, very similar, I have to say, to the Amazon Kindle Fire HD. Some of the specs that you're quoting suggest that you reckon the screen is slightly better. But in terms of the price, we're talking about pretty much the same sort of thing. And in terms of it being a sort of shop window, again, very, very much the same sort of thing. How then do you stack up against Amazon in terms of what you can offer people you know, to buy and to view?
The innovation that's in Nook HD 7-inch really focuses on a couple of core things that are different and matter to people who want to experience a great content. First, the screen resolution is dramatically better, which makes the viewing of movies and the experience in magazine content second to none. Two, our catalog of color content and available catalog for the UK customer is significantly better than those in the market. So we've been in the kids' interactive picture book space for a very long time, pioneered a format with the publishing industry on it. And so really when you think about families, the content differentiation we think is meaningful. On top of it, we've introduced profiles into Nook HD and HD Plus, which really focus on a family device. So Nook has, and Barnes & Noble has always been about the family of readers, whether it's, you know, dad who is reading the, you know, Winston Churchill biography, or it's mom who's, you know, reading British Vogue or 50 Shades of Grey. You know, potentially, you know, Sally doesn't, you know, need that as an 8-year-old. And so to be able to create profiles for unique members of the house, household, we think is both just a great innovation in the 7-inch category, but probably even more important as we go into the Christmas season, is a perfect value, right? It really extends your pound, you know, even further. So when you're buying, you know, the Nook product, you're getting more than just one 7-inch tablet.
And you can password protect these accounts.
Yes. So all of the accounts can be password protected. You can, you know, limit or eliminate access to shopping or to email. So it really does enable, you know, a parent to feel really good about, you know, kind of in the car, in the airplane, when you need to kind of, you know, give your kids something that will hopefully keep them occupied or get them excited about content, you know, you can feel safe about doing it.
The operating system underneath it is a forked version of Android. It's not the sort of Google Android, in as much as you don't have to sign into Google Mail, all that sort of thing. It's very much your own version of Android.
Yes, we again going back to creating a device and an experience on a device that's really tailored to the content experience. Android is a great operating system, but ultimately the user experience that we believe will deliver and, you know, render these rich content experiences, it was important for us to take that to the next level.
So a lot of people will have heard of Barnes & Noble in the US perhaps, but over here in the UK, not such a big name. What sort of content can you offer in the UK? Because obviously, you know, you have to have the deals with the book publishers, and that's been the source of some contention, certainly between Amazon and book publishers over here. Where is Barnes & Noble in this?
Well, I think it helps that we have always been great partners with the publishing industry. I think second, we've been working with UK publishers in our US business for that same period of time, right? So whether it's Penguin UK or it's Random House in the UK or it's Bloomsbury, which is a fantastic, you know, UK-based publisher that we love, those relationships matter in terms of coming into a market. And I think second, you know, we will have a full, brilliant catalog of books from UK publishing. So we feel, you know, very good that we're going to have a big catalog, certainly more books than any one reader will ever consume. So our ability with the publishing business to go create, you know, a robust catalog of books for users to be able to pick from, we're really comfortable with.
A lot of the analysis of the pricing of these 7-inch tablets and generally tablets suggests that the prices that you're selling at and the prices that Amazon are selling at is actually below cost, that you can't really have any margin on that, and that you need to make it up through people buying content. Is that analysis correct?
Clearly, the content side of the business is the core of what we do. So from a commercial perspective, there is no doubt that there is truth to the fact that the content is why we're building devices. I think that the analysis around the cost of the devices related to the price points, I think where I would leave it is that it isn't wholly accurate or applicable to the business that we're running. And part of it is the choices that you make and the efficiency that you put into the business as you create the products. We have a heritage of within our engineering team, people with very, very deep experience from companies like Palm and Apple. So these are people who have deep expertise in supply chain and sourcing. So without commenting specifically on the cost of the devices, we're comfortable with the economics that we have on both the devices and the content.
Though equally, having multiple accounts is the sort of thing which, you know, defrays the cost, because you only have to sell it once and you then profit each time someone's buying the content from you, I guess.
I think that it's a little bit more replicating what happens in a real household. In a real household, you go into a bookstore and mom buys a few books and dad buys a few books and their kids buy books. And why a device, you know, should have to be unique to each individual was something that we didn't think replicated what the family actually does related to books. And being a lover of books and being committed to families with books, it just made sense for us to do that.
My sort of experience with books is that one of us reads it and then passes it on to the other, which, I don't know, can you do that with this?
So it all a little bit depends on the publisher, but we were actually the first to introduce in the U.S. A capability called Lend Me, which did enable or does enable you to share a book with another Nook user for a window of time. And so there are many publishers who are taking advantage of it. Some, you know, are looking at lending differently, but we certainly think that the behavior of sharing books is an important one that our technology absolutely enables.
So let's get down to it. We've got a customer who's standing in a shop and they're looking at one of your devices, an Amazon Kindle Fire HD, and an iPad mini. Why should they buy yours?
You buy it for the quality of the product. So the resolution, the weight, and the ability to hold this product for a long period of time is the most important thing that you can do as a content user, whether you're on a long tube ride, you're on an airplane, whatever it may be. The actual quality of the physical hardware is really substantially better. Second, the unique capabilities related to the profiles we think is, one, a big differentiator, but two, a tremendous driver of value. So as you think about cost and price, space to a family, I think we're delivering more value into the product. And third, and most importantly, is the content itself. So, you know, I've talked a little bit about the fact that we've led in the kids' interactive picture books, but we've done the same in newspapers and magazines. We have a very competitive book catalog. We're introducing a movie service in the UK that's available for rental and download as well. So the content catalog is fantastic, but I would actually say we've created something called Nook Channels, which enables a different kind of discovery experience that makes the finding of the content that you're going to read next easier, more tailored to you, more personalized. We're great at that. We've been doing that for decades. We've now invested in putting that into these devices, unlike our competitors. And we think that those are very big differentiators for why you should buy us this Christmas.
One last question. Amazon, reckoned, actually limits the amount of Kindle devices, Kindle Fire devices, the tablet devices that it produces because of the loss that it's calculated to make on actually selling each one. Are you pursuing a similar sort of supply-limited strategy, or would you make as many as people could possibly buy?
Our job is to capture the ultimate largest amount of demand for the customers who want our devices. So we're very comfortable and excited about our supply chain position in terms of getting devices into the hands of the UK customers. And that's our job. We are really good at projecting, you know, our demand and understanding where the customer is from a market standpoint. We're making very big investments in coming into the UK because we think that we've got a great product for the UK customer, and we certainly think that we'll have plenty of product to meet that demand.
Jim Hilt from Nook, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And finally, there is a Steve Jobs biopic on the cards, and Charles has been crawling the dark underbelly of the film rumor mill to find out more. Charles, what's been going on?
What?
You've been crawling the dark underbelly of the film rumor mill.
It says here.
What I wrote, so it must be true.
Have I? Okay. There are actually two Steve Jobs biopics coming out. But the fun is that, one of them's got Ashton Kutcher, and the other one has got Aaron Sorkin writing the screenplay. So
let me just think
choice.
For a minute. I think we should claim victory here, because I'm sure we claimed in this very podcast that it would be an amazing idea for Aaron Sorkin to do
After
Facebook. He should do Apple, except, and then Google. So, yeah.
Well, actually, I think you're right. We did. And I think that as I was
writing
this, I thought, you know what? I wonder, haven't we heard this story before? But no, we made up the story and it became true.
It's pretty irresistible.
It's like on Star Trek with their communications devices.
Just like
that. If you build it, they will come.
Hey, what else can we predict?
So, Charles. It's sort of circular. Yeah. I'm still waiting for the teleporter. Okay, so the Aaron Sorkin one, which I think is actually the more interesting one in terms of how it's being structured. Sorkin says he's going to do it. It's going to be a 19-minute film with three scenes. And what he's doing is he's setting it in the moments before Jobs launches each of three products. The first is the Mac. The second is the next computer, when he had been thrown out of Apple and was trying to make a go of it with his own computer. And the third is the launch of the iPod in 2001. And that's it. And then he's going to bookend the film with the Apple advert about think different. You know, here's to the crazy ones, the ones who wouldn't blah 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 blah.
Oh,
can't remember how it goes.
So that's interesting. So we're not actually going to see any of the kind of the payoff. We're just going to see those very tense moments of anticipation before.
Yes, exactly. You see all the wind up to it. Yes.
And so ultimately, it is very much focused rather than being focused on Apple the company, which we often think is synonymous with Steve Jobs, certainly in the latter years with the cult of Steve, it would be very much focusing on the man. To what degree do you think that he would be taking from the Isaacson biography?
Well, he's pretty much pulling it all out of there. That's his source material. Though, you know, we know that Sorkin isn't necessarily grounded by what has actually transpired. And that was sort of, you know, very much the case with The Social Network.
It will be set in space. Brilliant.
Pigs in space.
Come back to Earth, Jemima. Will you go see it? Will you go see this film?
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, I was right at the front with the popcorn for
The Social Network.
I did actually.
I remember
Jemima
was
on our iPad.
No, I remember you were really excited about The Social Network when you came back to the studio. So,
well, we managed to make, you know, an hour and a half of really tense, really engaging drama about coding. Like, well done. Yeah. Yeah, amazing.
Coding and a legal argument.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's a double whammy there.
Some good twins in there, though, wasn't there? ultimately. Yes, well.
Did you have the hots for the twins?
I'm looking elsewhere. The Winkleburgers. Right, I'm looking at my script.
God.
And my script says, the tablet and ebook reader market. Oh, no, we've already read that.
I never would have put you down as a jock lover, but anyway.
But this has nothing to do with technology. It has everything to do with science. And so we'll move back to the technology.
Happy Christmas!
Yes, indeed. Merry Christmas to everybody. Charles, do you expect any surprises coming out of this? Do you expect people, Steve Jobs' estate, to be picketing outside the cinema?
I mean, I think that it's an interesting idea what Sorkin is going with here. It feels a bit like, I mean, there have been other films, I think, that have done this sort of, you know, snapshot through the life sort of format. I don't think it's that radical.
It's probably a good exercise, and he needed a good subject in which to do it. He was presented with this, and he thought, brilliant, this is the chance for
it's
me
a bit
to,
like,
to
I mean, he said he didn't
idea.
Want to do the sort of cradle to grave sort of thing, and it's the sort of format is a bit like what they call bottle episodes in series. And the bottle episode is a short for ship in a bottle, where you have it just in one place. So sometimes you'll notice, if you watch a TV series like Breaking Bad or Doctor Who, then you get an episode which is entirely set in one location. And, you know, they don't go outside the room or the spaceship or whatever. And, you know, those are sometimes the best.
Yep.
The idea they do, the reason they do them is because it's meant to be cheap.
And it's also incredibly tense, though, for the viewer.
Like the interrogation scene in Homeland, which is my favourite thing in the world at the moment.
Somehow this has turned into
that's
a media
not a
podcast.
Sorry. That's not a bottle episode, but yes.
Yeah, normal service will be resumed.
Indeed, later after Christmas. Yeah. And Charles, the Aaron, not the Aaron Sorkin, the Ashton Kutcher version?
Ashton Kutcher is meant to be meant to be coming out sometime next year.
Great. Well, we look forward to reviewing that when it does arise. Thank you very much for listening. That's everything for this week. Thanks also to Charles and Jemima for joining for the hilarity in the studio. Next week, we're talking about games. What do you need to have under the holiday tree this season? The Christmas tree, the holiday tree. Which country am I in? I'm not 100% sure. Find out next week. This podcast.
Ash tree.
Yes, indeed. Yes. This podcast. Oh, God. So now suddenly we're the environment podcast. There you go. Everything under one roof here. Here on Tech Weekly. The podcast this week was produced by Jason Phipps. Thank you for herding the cats. I'm Alex Protoski. See you next week.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.